You are listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast. To learn more about Passion City Church, including our gathering times in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com. Today's talk comes from Pastor Ben Stewart.
Well, I have a confession to make, church. I never really watched the TV show Friends. Actually, wasn't a fan of it at all. But, okay, some cheers. All right. Wow. Oh, shocking. Okay, interesting moment here, church. I got to move on, but that's curious. Find me later. But I did watch one episode with Phoebe. I remember she came into their apartment or whatever, and they were watching the show Old Yeller. And they were all crying, and she was confused. Why are you crying? And they were like, because it's Old Yeller. She was like, it's a happy family film. And they're like, what? Even the end? And she said, well, yeah, he saves the family from wolves. And then my mom would always turn off the TV and say, the end, they lived happily ever after. And they were like, I think your mom held some things back from you. And then she begins to watch the end of Old Yeller unfold, the rabies. And you see her going, Tommy, put the gun down. What are you doing? And she sees, well, there's some tragedy woven into the back end of this story, right? Now, why mention that? Because that's exactly where we are in the life of David. We're going to get to a point that we like to skip sometimes, but there is a place for sadness. Inside Out taught us that. That if you try to drive sadness out of your mind and stuff it down deep inside, it will wreak havoc on you and joy will get lost with it. That we have to journey with sadness if we want to see hope return. And so here we're going to get to a point in David's life where honestly, we like to just stay focused on the happy parts. Preachers like to do that. He's anointed by God. He killed Goliath. He escaped King Saul. He became king. And then we rush to, and he handed the kingdom off to Solomon. And we skip this part where he neglected his children, was a bad dad, and his kids ended up killing each other. We don't like this part. And yet if we skip it, it's like avoiding going to the doctor because we're afraid of the diagnosis. You don't heal a wound by ignoring it. We have to look at it if we want healing to come. And the opportunity we have before us today is to not repay the learning tax that David paid as we look at this difficult moment in his life. We're going to watch the aged King David, probably in his 60s, trudge barefoot out of the kingdom because he is cast out by his young son Absalom, who usurps him in the throne. We're going to see a tragedy take place. And my hope is, as we look at his tragedy, it'll save us from tragedies in our own life. And maybe this journey of sadness with David will bring us some joy in the end. But let me give you a warning as we begin. There are many ways to divide a culture. There's many ways to carve us up. And one of them is by age and generation. Like these kids today, you're okay, boomer, that sort of thing. But we're going to touch on this generational pain today, okay? And I just want to let you know out front, my goal is to bother two groups of people. Old people and young people. So it's equal opportunity bothering today, okay? And opportunity for us to learn. So I'm just warning you now, don't get arrogant. If you start to get smug like, yeah, you old people, or yeah, you kids, be careful because he's coming for you too, all right? We're going to look at the folly of the aging king. And we're going to look at the foolishness of the young priest. Prince, right? Now, the David and Absalom story covers seven chapters. We don't have time to read that all, but there are 7 days in a week, and I would encourage you to read these one a chapter a day over the next week and really get a handle on what I'm going to really comment on now. So I'm going to give us three main points and kind of summarize along the way, and my hope is that we will learn from David's mistakes. But the first point is this. As we look at this section, we're going to watch David reaps what he sows. David will reap what he sows. The sins of the past will catch up with him. Like in The Godfather, when Vito Corleone came back to Italy 20 years later to kill Don Ciccio. It's coming for you. It's a reference apparently few of you get. How do you live in D.C. and not know God? Anyway, so the reality is the chaos that David sent out into the world in his youth will now come home to roost in his old age. And we saw it last week that David, against the expressed commandments of Deuteronomy that said a king must not multiply wives, he used his power and did it anyway. And in his proliferation of wives, he had a number of children, eventually creating a royal court of young men with way too much time and not near enough character. And David develops this royal court, and he does not disciple this next generation. And now we will see they manifest the worst of his qualities. So last week we saw in chapter 11 that David had lured Bathsheba to his house and slept with her, then murdered her husband. And as we get into 2 Samuel 13, we see in verse 1, now Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, loved her. And Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible to Amnon to do anything to her. Do anything to her. Those words are haunting. Because Tamar will tell him later that she is a half-sister, and in that day it would have been appropriate for them to get married, but that's not what he has in mind. And so what he does is recruits his cousin to come up with a plan where they trick David to tell him he's sick as he lays in bed, send Tamar to care for me, and as Tamar arrives in his bedroom, he sends all of his servants out and says, come and lie with me. And she says in verse 12, no, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this outrageous thing. But verse 14 says he would not listen to her, and being stronger than her, he violated her and lay with her. Then Amnon hated her with very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he loved her. We find out what Amnon's love really looks like. It's just lust. It's, I want your body, but I don't care about your soul. It's the commodification of a person. Then he tries to cast her out. She says, don't do this. You have to take responsibility. And he says, literally, get this out of my presence. We translate it in English, this woman, but he doesn't say woman. He so dehumanizes her, he calls her this. Now, there's a lot we can say here, particularly about the pain of those who have been violated. We talked some about that last week, but I want to focus in on one of the things that the passage really aims us at here that Robert Alter comments on. He says, the catastrophic turn in David's fortune begins when he saw a beautiful woman and lusted after her. Now the curse pronounced by Nathan on the house of David begins to unfold in the very same mechanism, a sexual transgression within the royal quarters resulting in an act of murder elsewhere. I didn't cover the murder, but David, when he finds out about the violation of Tamar, is angry, but he does nothing. And as he does nothing, his son Absalom takes it into his own hands and he murders his brother. And you see, where David had given in to sexual sin and violence, you now watch within his house, his sons give into that same sexual sin and that same kind of violence. That David, in his old age, begins to reap what he sowed. That's the point I'm trying to make. That point one is your inputs make outcomes. Your choices have consequences. The Bible says it this way, that desire when it's conceived gives birth to sin, and sin when it's fully grown brings forth death. That David, when he united himself with his desires, he brought sin into the world and death into the world. And now it's come even to his own house. David played with deceptive desires and they brought destruction into his home. He sowed the wind and now he's reaping the whirlwind. Now, what I'm not saying here is that I believe in the Americanized version of karma, that every bad thing you do, it's bad things coming back at you. That's not necessarily how the scripture works. That'll be clear by the end of this. But what I'm saying is there is a principle in the planet today that inputs have outcomes, that our decisions lead to destinations. Our choices have consequences. What we sow, we will reap. If you spend all your money now, you won't have any in the future. If you don't invest in quality friendships now, you will be alone when your time of trouble comes. And generationally speaking, we don't sin alone. We like to think that, well, no, my life is my choices. No, we sin on display. And when we're an older generation, our decisions affect the next generation. That doesn't make David responsible for Amnon's choices, but it does have David has to get his head around the reality that he set the stage for them. I remember there was a song when I was a kid called The Cat's in the Cradle and the Silver Spoon. Have you ever heard this song? Okay, like seven of you. Yes, all right. It goes like this. I remember my dad loved the song. My child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way. But there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away. And he was talking before I knew it, and as he grew, he said, I'm gonna be like you, Dad. I'm going to be like you. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man in the moon. When you coming home, Dad? I don't know when, but we'll get together then. You know we'll have a good time then. My son turned 10 just the other day. He said, thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, let's play. Can you teach me to throw? I said, not today. I got a lot to do. And he said, that's okay. And he walked away, but his smile never dimmed. It said, I'm going to be like him. Yeah, you know, I'm going to be like him. And then the song ends. I've long since retired. My son's moved away. I called him up just the other day. I said, I'd like to see you if you don't mind. He said, I'd love to, Dad, if I can find the time. But you see, my new job's a hassle. The kids have the flu. But it sure was nice talking to you, Dad. It's been nice talking to you. And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me, he'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man in the moon. When you coming home, son? I don't know when, but we'll get together then, Dad. We're gonna have a good time then. And I remember as a kid hating that song. What a terrible song. I didn't even have any kids I'd screwed up yet. And I still was like, I don't wanna hear this. It's terrible. But the reality is there that what we sow, we will reap. And what I put on display in front of my child, he now displays in his own life. And it's wisdom that forces us to look at this. And what the reality is in David's life too, it's not just a repetition of David's sins reproduced in his children's life. There's an intensification of it. That you see that the way the text unfolds, that David, obviously what he did with Bathsheba was horrendous. And then you see Amnon does the same thing, but with his own sister. You see with Bathsheba, the text is silent about her motivations. And so you're left unsure, though it's clearly a sin of David's. In Tamar's, you hear her cry, do not do this thing. And where David ultimately married Bathsheba and took care of the child, you see that Amnon casts her out and calls her this thing. And you see that sin doesn't just roll downstream, it intensifies, it picks up steam, that David's movement towards sex and violence becomes an even more dangerous movement towards sex and violence in the next generation. And this happens. Sin is not content to stay the same size. It eats and it grows and becomes more hungry. And arguments and disrespect become violence and murder. And the pinup photos of, I don't know, the 20s, 30s, 40s are tame by pornographic standards today because sin is not content to stay the same size. It rolls downstream. And David's sins aren't just repeated in his children, they're intensified, right? And that's true for all of us. You see it in our music. We've come a long way from I wanna hold your hand to WAP. That's a journey. I'm just giving you some information here, folks, that we're at a different place in the river, right? I remember for me when this first stood out to me is the song No Diggity by Blackstreet. Are you familiar? Anyone? Okay, thank God. I remember being out shopping once and hearing that familiar tune, right? I was like, oh, I know where this is going. Okay. All right. And I'm getting ready for it. And then you can imagine my shock when I hear grandma's hands clap in church. Wait, what? What? Grandma's hands? And what I learned in that moment was, oh, Blackstreet sampled this song. It was originally about grandma's hands clapped in church on Sunday morning. And now it's, I like the way you work it, no diggity, I got to bag it up. And you're like, okay, let's just mark where we are. Where this was previously about our grandmother's prayer life, we've changed it to an emotionless sexual encounter. That's a journey. Now, let me be clear, again, generational, who we blaming this on. So if you're old in here, you can be like, yeah, these perverted kids today. And then you're young here, you go, hey, you're the people in charge of media. You put these phones in our hands, you perverts. We can all blame each other. But the reality stays the same, that sins, they flow downstream and they intensify. And what we sow, we will reap. And you need to see that in your own life. What do you tolerate as entertainment in your life now that requires the numbing of your conscience? don't be foolish enough to think it won't affect your children or the culture you live in. The sins of the parents influence the children. They do. And beware, if you're young, the hallmark of youth in America is to try to say that your decisions won't lead to destinations. You're supposed to do something wild and crazy when you're young. Choices don't have consequences. Just do whatever. That's a silly thing to say to you, because what you sow, you will reap. And many of us, we are sowing chaos and praying for a crop failure. And it doesn't always work that way, right? If you are brutal online, do not be surprised when the culture is brutal back to you. If you are heartless, don't be surprised when you're surrounded by those who don't care about you. When you're callous and indifferent to the needs of others, don't be shocked when no hand extends towards you. I warn my girls all the time, be kind to your little brother, because it's almost certain that in a few years he will be much bigger than you and you will wish you had. And be content to make war on your sin while it's small. Don't dismiss it because it's little, because it grows. Don't feed Humphrey, as they say. Many of you have read that article about the guy that rescued a hippo and fed it as a pet until it killed him. Because hippos kill people. And you be careful that you're not feeding a cute little sin, because its desire is to devour you. You be careful. Fight it when it's small. Right? And David sows chaos and he reaps the whirlwind. I told you this was an upbeat sermon. It gets better, I promise. Point number two is David's passivity is as dangerous as his activity. David's passivity is as dangerous as his activity. The sins of omission are as bad as the sins of commission, right? So maybe it's just neglect. Maybe it's because he's old and tired. Maybe it's because of his shame, because of his own failures. So he's reticent to bring justice and discipline to his own kid's life. But when David is meant to step forward as a leader, he does not. He does not punish Amnon for what he did to Tamar. And in that absence and vacuum of leadership, Absalom rages at the injustice and does something about it. And he chooses to murder his brother. And when Absalom commits murder in the court, David does nothing. And Absalom flees in anticipation of judgment, but David does not act. Absalom finally, through some machinations with Joab, gets David to convince him to come back, but David says he can come back halfway. He says, let him depart to his own house. He is not to come in my presence. So Absalom lived apart in his own house and did not come into the king's presence. Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. He says, okay, he can come over there, but I still don't want to deal with him. And David decides to do nothing. And in the midst of that doing nothing, Absalom grows impatient at the apathy of his father and says, hey, I'm either back in or out. Either kill me or reinstate me, but I don't want this halfway deal. And so he tries to get attention. He's calling Joab, the commander of the military, trying to get a hookup to get advance. Can't get his attention, so he burns Joab's fields down like you do. He goes gangster. I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse, right? Destroys his crops. So Joab comes up and he says, Joab, either get me instated or get me killed. And Joab gets him reinstated. And so Absalom in that moment decides, okay, now I'm back in full royal court. He comes riding in on a chariot, looking kingly with his flowing hair. And he stops at the gate and he rolls his sleeves up and loosens his tie and starts to hang out with the common man and says, hey, are you coming to Jerusalem for justice? Are you going to petition the government to solve your problems? They won't do it. The people in power don't care about you. Oh, but if I was king, I would solve your problems. I'd care about you. I'm fighting for the little guy. And he kind of runs this political campaign that it says he steals the heart of the people. Then he asks dad if he can go to Hebron, the former capital. And when he goes there, he declares himself king, marshals an army, and comes to lay waste to Jerusalem. And David, seeing that a slaughter is coming to his people, has to flee barefoot out of the city, across the river, and up the mountain on the other side. And you see, David's passivity leaves a vacuum. And into that vacuum, Absalom brings chaos. The only thing needed for evil to increase is for the good to do nothing. And David fails to act, and it costs him, and it costs the whole kingdom. It was a failure as a father. There's that old statement, right? If we do not initiate the boys, they will burn down the village, right? Both of those ideas are wrong. Failing to initiate, failing to disciple the boys was a mistake of David's. That doesn't make what Absalom did right. If you burn down everything, that's wrong, because then you're left with no things. So David's wrong, but Absalom's wrong. This whole situation's wrong. It's a shame. But much of this happens because of David's refusal to act. David was the king. He had the power to administer justice, and in failing to use his power, he left chaos in the kingdom. Sins of omission are as bad as sins of commission. Our failure to act can be just as bad as our actions, right? The Bible talks about this a lot. James chapter 4 says, whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. The Bible doesn't just say, hey, try not to do bad stuff and be a good person. It says, no, hey, what is the good God has empowered you to do? You're meant to do that thing. We are meant to be agents of good in the world. My children just found my old vinyl, my record of the soundtrack of Superman 2 starring Christopher Reeves. I'm very nervous that they discovered it because it's awesome and they break things, but it's pretty cool. You hold the vinyl into the light and you can see a little image of Superman's symbol on it. It's very cool. And so they want to listen to it. They put it on the record player and I see it set up there. And I'm like, oh wow, they've never seen this story. Children, gather around. Let me tell you the story of Superman 2 starring Christopher Reeves. What happens in that movie? Superman saving people, saving the day. And he gets a little bored. I don't know. Be Superman, but you know what? I kind of want to hook up with Lois Lane. And for some reason, you can't be Superman and do that. I don't really understand the mechanics of that. It's a vehicle for the plot to move along. And so he decides, I have to divest myself of superpowers to be with Lois. And I would rather do that, quite frankly. And so he pitches the whole super thing to hook up with Lois and the Fortress of Solitude. And while he's doing that, superpowered beings arrive that have no moral character, and they lay waste to America and the world. And Superman's great sin in Superman 2 is that he abdicated power when it was in his power to do what's right. And that's the same with David and you and me. Proverbs says it this way: rescue those who are being taken away to death. Hold back those who are stumbling to the slaughter. If you say, behold, we do not know this, does not he who weigh the heart perceive it? Does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it? And will he not repay according to his work? We can't look at a hurting world and go, I don't know, it's not my deal. I'm just trying to take care of myself. No, if we see people stumbling towards death and do nothing, the Bible says you're meant to take the good I gave you and do good with it. Jesus told the story, the parable of the talents, disturbing story, where he says God has distributed talents like money and said, invest them and make a profit. And to the one who gave 10 or 5, he made 5 more. To the one who gave 3, he made 3 more. And the one who had 1 buried it. And God doesn't say, yeah, sometimes you got to bury your talents. You know what I mean? It's a crazy world. That's not what God says. He says, no, I gave you good. I gave you the potential energy, the gifting, the talent to do good. You've done wrong by failing to act. One of the meetings I was in Miami was a group of people that are successful and their careers, the jobs they're doing are pretty amazing, pretty inspirational. But as we sat at dinner, we didn't really talk so much about their careers. And frankly, there was no small talk. We didn't talk about the weather. We didn't talk about our outfits, nothing like that. As soon as we sat down, these couples were very focused on their passion, which was, as it began, ending human trafficking, the selling of humans and exploiting of people. And that moved into the obvious issues of poverty around the world and the growing number of children rising up in poverty. It's like, how do we solve that? How do we change the structures that allow children to flourish when they're young? And then as we did that, we talked about, you know, you can build all these external structures, but if people have corrupt hearts, they corrupt structures. We need to see a renovation of people's hearts. And so they were asking, how do you preach the gospel to someone who has numbed their conscience, that has become a murderer of children or is leading as a warlord? How do you do that? How do you share Christ in prison? How do you share Christ with someone who's demon-possessed? I'm telling you, this conversation got wild. I'm like, well, let me give you a couple options when someone's got a demon inside. And so we're just talking about all this crazy stuff. But I remember watching them and I'm like, you people, this isn't even your job. And yet it's a passion of yours. You see where the fabric of society is breaking and saying, but I have gifts, abilities, creativity, and finances. I want to lean into the tragedies of the world. And I'm going to use my creativity to try to innovate. I'm going to use my relationships to try to pool our best ideas. I'm going to use my money and time and energy to make a difference for the sake of the next generation. And I remember listening to them and it struck me. One, I was like, what am I doing with my life? You know, and then I was like, oh, you know, I think I'm doing something good, but I need to do more of that. And then I thought, and no one has a right to be bored. If you're sitting around and just bored and searching for the next entertainment, I want to encourage you to lift up your gaze to the brokenness in the world and say, don't be the king reclining on his throne, sitting there eating grapes while the world burns. The kingdom is in need. And if God has empowered you to do good, we're meant to do it. And David's passivity creates an environment for chaos. Right? Number three, it gets better, I promise. Almost. One more point. Number three. David's impotence does not excuse Absalom's arrogance. So David refuses to act. David does no good. And yet when we look at Absalom, something weird begins to happen as we look at their stories. David has to flee the kingdom. And as he flees, something weird happens. You know, David, it's disturbing because he was our hero through most of this series. And then last week he became the bad guy. It's disturbing. And this week you see this impotent David that refuses to act. He's still the bad guy. And yet as he journeys out and begins to take on the consequences for his choices, something begins to shift. David starts to become the hero again. It's like the fire looked like it was out, but there's still some coals there that begin to move. And as David journeys out of the kingdom, the people are weeping and some come to him and say, I'll go with you. And he says, no, you need to take care of yourself. This is where Zadok the priest comes and says, I'll take the ark. Let's take the ark out with us. And David says, no, leave the ark of God in the temple of God in the city of God. He says, and if the Lord has favor on me, the Lord will bring me back. If the Lord does not, I trust myself into the Lord's hands. He finds out that Absalom has the best counselor in the kingdom on his side. And he says, oh, Lord, help us. And the next person that comes up is the second greatest counselor in the kingdom. And David's like, thank you, Lord. Can you go back and just see what you can do in the kingdom? Then David gets cursed at. Some guy starts throwing stones at him. I mean, David's walking barefoot. Everyone's crying. And some dude starts pelting him with rocks and saying, you get what you deserve. And David's commander is like, with your permission, king, may I please cut that man's head off? And David was like, no, 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 no. David said, hey, my choices led to these curses. Let him go. And perhaps the Lord will be merciful to me. And you see a David that's not arrogant. You see a David that's not making excuses. You see a David who's humble and David who's repentant. You see some of that old greatness in him. It's like the lion that's been asleep is waking up again. And then you start to see Absalom in a new light. Absalom, who saw the injustice of David and was rightly angry, you start to see some weird things about him that we didn't read earlier. It's worth reading now in chapter 14. It says of Absalom earlier, now in all of Israel, there was no one so much to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. Who's checking the soles of his feet? Dang. And when he cut the hair of his head, for at the end of every year he used to cut it, when it was heavy on him, he cut it. That's so hard. And he weighed the hair of his head, 200 shekels by the king's weight. Can you believe it? We find out about Absalom, he's hot. And that's all we ever find out about him. And yet we find out that he said he cares about the common man. If I was in power, I'd care about the common man. But when he comes to power, he doesn't. That was just a story to get power. And as he gets power, he wants to learn how to consolidate his power. And in that bid to consolidate it, his counselor, whose name is long and I will not pronounce, starts with an A. A says to him, you know what you really need to do is get up on that rooftop of your dad's and sleep with his concubines in front of everybody to show everybody that you're sticking it to your dad and you're in charge now. And so Absalom does it. And you go, wow, that's bold and weird. I remember when I first moved to DC, I met with this guy and I just wanted to learn about the city and he'd been a lifelong resident. I was like, man, tell me about DC. What's going on here? And he was like, well, DC is filled with people with father wounds who are chasing success to try to get revenge on their dad who didn't pay attention to them when they were young. And I was like, dang, okay. I thought you were going to tell me like the names of some coffee shops, but all right, let's get real. I don't know what brought you to DC, But he was explaining Absalom. And what you find is interesting here is David had served under a king, Saul, and Absalom, as he's described, sounds a little bit more like Saul than David. Saul was hot and no character. And Absalom seems to be painted the same way. And it's fascinating. When David served Saul, Saul was old. And when Saul was the old king and David was young, he saw David and David made him feel insecure. Can you be talented and powerfully used by God and deeply insecure? See Saul. Anointed by God, victor over the Philistines, deeply insecure. And so when he sees a young leader, rather than bless and disciple and mentor him, he sees him as a threat and he undermines him verbally and then physically throws spears at him. Some of you have bosses that do that. You threaten them and they throw spears. But David in that moment is faithful. He refuses to attack King Saul. In fact, he has two opportunities to murder Saul we looked at and he doesn't do it. I don't care if Saul's a spear thrower, I won't be. I don't care if he undermines me, I will not disrespect him. I don't care if he comes after me, I will not retaliate. I will continue to do what's right. I won't beat a Saul by becoming a Saul. I will do what's right. I'll disciple young men. I'll save those in need. I will continue to put good into the world, trusting the Lord will guide my story, and he does. And you see, David refuses to retaliate, and he refuses to divide the kingdom. He will not try to usurp Saul's throne. And yet Absalom is working overtime to undermine David. Always coming after the king, resenting his leadership, resenting that he's on the throne and not me, standing at the gate and saying, well, if I was king, I would do it this way. If I was king, I would do it this way. Fomenting the resentment in his heart. And finally, when he has sufficient power, he attacks David, more than willing to put his hands on the Lord's anointed, actively seeking to kill him. And what you see is an Absalom looks like a Saul. All talent, no character. And talent without character is a tragedy waiting to happen. Did what David do was wrong? Yes. But does that vindicate Absalom to be vengeful? No. Do not use the status of victim as an excuse to become vengeful. Don't let that wickedness inside. Absalom does, and it won't go well for him. And it's fascinating. There's a great book called Three Kings, and it's talking to those who maybe feel like they're under an oppressive leader. Maybe some of you have parents that way or a boss that way or someone that's constantly undermining you, but they're in power. And you're like, if I was in power, I'd run this place better than that. He says, you be careful, because when you're an Absalom, everybody looks like a Saul. You need to get Saul out of here. Look at him. He doesn't care about us. Look at his insecurity. Look at et cetera. And you think when you're an Absalom that every king, even good-hearted Davids, look like Sauls to you. And so your king may be a Saul or you might be an Absalom. Or if you're old and you resent the young people, these kids today, and they're doing this and they're trying to take my power and I'm gonna hold on to it and you can't, I don't wanna invest in you, I don't wanna waste my time with you. If you are an older king and you're threatened by the young ones, they might be Absaloms biting for your throne. Or you might be a Saul, because Saul threw spears at a David. Because to Sauls, everyone behind them is a threat. Even the Davids look like Absaloms. And when you're an Absalom, everyone above you is a threat. Even the Davids look like Saul. And if all you see are Sauls and Absaloms, it's because you might be one. And you see that Absalom has the same sickness Saul had, that his vanity and insecurity take over, because they're twin sides of the same coin. They're both absorption with self. And that proves to be Absalom's undoing. Absalom decides, I gotta move and do something else, and his Council A tells him, well, your dad's fleeing on foot. Let me take some men. Let me and go kill your dad. I will go kill him. You'll consolidate the throne and you'll be in power. It's actually good advice. I mean, David's exhausted. He's 60 and on foot up a mountain. He's smoked. It'd be a great time to kill him. It's good advice. But then Absalom looks at Hushai, David's plant, and says, what do you think, Hushai? And Hushai is careful enough to say, to appeal to the insecurity and the vanity of an Absalom. He was like, ooh, I don't know. He said, everybody knows your dad's like a she-bear robbed of her cubs. Your dad is a warrior of old. He starts talking about young David like that's still the case. Like in that Indiana Jones movie, they're talking about he will blend in, disappear to that lost old man. He's talking about David like, oh man, David, he is a warrior out in the desert. If you go out there now, he's going to kill you. He's going to undermine you. I'd be careful. Ooh, man, and he appeals to Absalom's insecurity. And then he flips around and appeals to his vanity. He says, but my counsel is that all at Israel be gathered to you, from Dan to Bethsheba, as the sands by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person. He's like, don't send some other guys. You need to rally an army. You need a big army. You need a big army riding behind you. You need to be the victor. So wait a little while till you can get your army. And he appeals to his insecurity and his vanity. And Absalom's like, yeah, I like that. I'm doing that. And so he waits and waits and waits. And meanwhile, David finds out what's going on. David gets his army marshaled. And then in chapter 18, Absalom rides out to battle. And we find out that he just happens to meet the servants of David while verse 9, Absalom was riding on his mule. The mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak. That's embarrassing. And he was suspended between heaven and earth, like all the proud. While the mule that was under him went on, that's even more embarrassing. And a certain man saw it and told Joab, behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak. And Joab said to the man who told him, what? You saw him? Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? And I won't read it later, but they do, and it's gross. Absalom gets super killed, right? Why? Because God opposes the proud and gives grace to the humble. Was David wrong? Yes, but Absalom had so many ways to do what's right. You can pray, you can petition the king, you can disciple and mentor, you could act like David under Saul, but rather you used the fact that you were victimized to become a victimizer, and you let that resentment harden and congeal into arrogance and anger, and you became dangerous. And God has to oppose the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And you see, Absalom's untold arrogance is his undoing, and that glorious hair, the 3-shekel hair, gets caught up in a tree, and that's his undoing. Now, you hear all this and you go, wow, Ben, these are great warnings. I'm going to play with some kids and give away money and not be a jerk. This is so helpful. But is there any hope or are all my sins coming after me? Well, let me end with some hope. David has to wander when he sees his sin and he has to leave and taste the consequences of his choices. But as he does it, did you notice what he said? Keep the ark. Perhaps God will be gracious to me. Maybe he won't. It's up to him. But he puts himself in the hands of the Lord. And then he walks across the river and ascends the Mount of Olives. And it's there that we find out in the text that Yahweh works the battle to rescue David, draw him back into the kingdom. And as he arrives in the kingdom, David becomes king again. And he's a king with a humbled heart. And what happens? David is able to hand the kingdom off successfully to Solomon. And when he hands it off to Solomon, Solomon leads the kingdom into its best day. And do you know who helps David as one more coup occurs by another one of his wicked sons, helps establish Solomon who leads with righteousness and wisdom? It's Nathan who convicted David of his sin and Zadok the priest who was there with him on the walk of shame. It's when David was honest about his sin that the community around him helped him come back into the kingdom of blessing and bless the next generation so that generations could be blessed through them. I don't know what kind of ashes you're sitting in, but God is in the business of bringing beauty from ashes. So you may listen to this and go, man, this would have been a great sermon 10 years ago before I burned my house down. Will you be encouraged? Because the David that was run out of the kingdom was brought back. Why? The key word was the favor of the Lord. That's the word grace. Because the beauty of our message is that grace, to quote Bono, travels outside of karma. It gives us what we do not deserve. David is reaping what he sowed. And yet, God reestablished him as king. Why? Because generations later, another child will be born in the little town of Bethlehem, the city of David. He will become from godly lineage. He's the one that God promised David. A king will come from you who will rule forever. Jesus, the son of David. Why is he called the son of David? David doesn't look like a hero here. Well, here's why. David's not a hero. Can't really cheer for Absalom. The Bible is quick to show you there are no heroes in here except one. And the reality is we meet him later, that in the city of David, the son of David, Jesus Christ, on the night he was betrayed, sits at dinner with his disciples and breaks the bread and says, "This will be broken like my body will be broken for your sin." He had them drink from the cup and he said, "This is my blood that's being poured out because God's making a covenant with you." And then he said, "Let's go." And do you know where he went? He crossed the river. He walked up the Mount of Olives. He did the same walk as King David. And then he knelt down in the Garden of Gethsemane and said, "Not my will, but yours be done." And where David entrusts himself to God's hand and finds grace and a kingdom restored, the son of David entrusts himself into God's hands. And what happened? He who knew no sin became sin for you and me. How could David not reap the full consequences of his sin? Because someone else reaped them for him. How could David not eat the full harvest of the chaos he sowed? Because the wrath of God fell on the son of David, Jesus Christ. What's your hope and mine today? It's the favor, the grace of God who has sent the true King, who has sent Jesus Christ to walk with you through the valley of tears, to weep with you as you repent, to walk with you up the Mount of Olives. And then this King takes your sin, your shame for you and says, "You stand there. Let me take the hit. Let me take your sin. Me take your shame. I get buried, but I rise triumphant. And as I do, I'm leading you home to a kingdom and a future. And I'm bringing shalom, peace to you if you trust me." There's no heroes in this book and there's no heroes in this room except for one, Jesus Christ. And when you put your faith in him, where you may have sown chaos, now you can sow peace. Where you maybe have sown that little kernel of death and it reaped a harvest of death, Jesus said, if it remains alone, unless the seed falls to the ground, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. He said, "I'm the seed that falls, and a harvest of grace rises." And you let that seed of grace land in your heart. God loves to take sinful Davids and make them into Savior Davids. You can be something else. You can sow beauty in the culture. You can sow kindness into the old generation and the young. You can sow gifts of peace. You can step away from apathy and into action for God's grace. And you can do it with humility, knowing that God leads your story. You can follow with the one true King and watch what he does to a human life. That though there may be sorrow for the night, joy comes in the morning. And though today you may walk in tears, you look out because those who walk with him in tears and sow in tears, they reap with joy.
If you were encouraged by today's talk, be sure to rate us and hit subscribe on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you stream your podcasts. To experience other talks, videos, and live gatherings, visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com or download the Passion Movement app. And again, thanks for listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast.